I mentioned this morning, I mentioned that I wanted to preach on a tale of two cities. And we'll begin with that and transition here in a moment. Both cities are unique in that as I study them, they're really more alike than maybe I would have thought. The first city, not a city of great might. Rather, it was really a vassal of another king, part of a valley region of other kingdoms as well. And they finally got tired of their vassal state, of being subjected to this ruler. And so they revolted. And subsequently, they were punished. That king came down and defeated them once again. There was a king in this city who offered to pay the patriarch Abram for his rescue, but was declined. The other city was also not a city of great size, though maybe we have considered it such in Scripture. It wasn't one of maybe outstanding economic power. It did have a good spring located nearby and apparently a guarding wall. But both cities ended up destroyed. If you could think of the first city that was somehow intertwined with the man Abram, what city would you think of? Sodom. Sodom was the city. The second city was intertwined with the people of Jericho the people of Israel sometime later, and it was the city of Jericho. But as I had talked about this with my wife, she came out with this phrase today, and I was like, that is exactly it. And so, no, she didn't give me my outline, but she helped me with my title. It's not really so much the tale of two cities as it is the tale of two citizens. A tale of two citizens. Now, I'll read some of the descriptions for you, then we'll go back to the passages depending on how much time that we have. A tale of two citizens. There's a woman saved and a man destroyed. One woman who started as an unbeliever who is not unusually wealthy, as far as we know. One man who started as a believer and was quite blessed materially. One woman whose life ended with the blessedness of salvation and the prospect of God's blessing, but one man whose life ended with the stain of sexual sin, having lost the majority of his family and virtually all of his wealth. One woman who, because of her faith, became a key link in the procreation of the Messiah. One man who, because of his sin, became the key link in the procreation of two evil people groups. One woman, though known as a harlot, became a picture of faith. One man, though known as the nephew of the father of our faith, came to sexual perversion near the end. Lot was drawn by Sodom and lost his family. Rahab gave up Jericho and was instrumental in saving hers. Now, if you turn to Genesis chapter 19, we'll begin in Genesis 19. I'm a little afraid to assume that you know and remember the details of the story, and so I do want to cover some of the text here so that you remember. In Genesis number chapter 19, we begin right there in verse number 1. And there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom, and Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet them. And he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, behold now, my lords, turn in, I pray you, into your servant's house, and tarry all night, and wash your feet, and ye shall rise up early and go on your ways. And they said, nay, but we will abide in the street all night. And he pressed upon them greatly, and they turned in unto him and entered into his house. And he made them a feast and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round about, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, where are the men which came in unto thee this night? Bring them out unto us that we may know them. Of course, you understand that that doesn't mean so that we might learn more of their background and find out what their hobbies are. When it says that we may know them, it means in a more intimate way. And Lot went out at the door unto them and shut the door after them and said, I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold, now I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof. Now we could comment on the depravity of that statement, but let's move on. And they said, stand back. And they said again, this one fellow came in to sojourn, and he will needs be a judge. Now will we deal worse with thee than with them. And they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, and came near to break the door. But the men put forth their hand and pulled Lot into the house and shut the door. And they smote the men that were at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves to find the door. And so now the angels warn him, we're going to destroy this place, get your family, leave the city. And Lot, it says, verse 14, Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which indicates that he had daughters who were married, sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. It seemed like he was actually being funny. He was trying to just joke around with them. That's the way it was perceived by them. And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters. Nobody else will come with you. Influence didn't stretch that far, but at least you have your wife and two daughters in the home. Take them, let's go, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. Verse 16, and while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand and upon the hand of his wife and upon the hand of his two daughters. And the Lord being merciful unto him, they brought him forth and set him without the city. It came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad that he said, escape for thy life. Look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. Now notice this. And Lot said unto them, oh, not so, my Lord. I think that also reveals the character of Lot that he had lived with for some time. Oh, not so, my Lord. Behold, now thy servant hath found grace in thy sight, and thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast showed unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die. Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And save my soul alive. Isn't that interesting, that parenthetical statement? Is it not a little one, that little childish repetition of the excuse, of the plea? He said unto him, see, I have accepted thee concerning this thing also, that I will not overthrow this city for the which thou hast spoken. Haste thee, escape thither, for I cannot do anything till thou become thither. Therefore the name of that city was called Zoar. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered into Zoar. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And this is such a touching story to me. Verse 27, Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord, and he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. We're going to stop on that for right now and turn over to Joshua chapter 2. We're comparing now the life of two citizens. In Joshua chapter number 2, we see what the life of Lot looked like there for a while. And now Joshua chapter number 2 and verse number 1. And Joshua the son of Nun sent out of Shittim two men to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, even Jericho. And they went and came into an harlot's house named Rahab and lodged there. Now, we'll consider Rahab's life in a moment, but I want to tell you this happening that the spies launch out into the city of Jericho and just happen to land at the house of a lady named Rahab. That's no coincidence. That's no coincidence. I truly believe that God was leading those men specifically to that home. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, there come men in hither tonight of the children of Israel to search out the country. The king of Jericho sent unto Rahab, saying, bring forth the men that are come to thee, which are entered into thine house, for they be come to search out all the country. And the woman took the two men and hid them and said thus, there came men unto me, but I wist not whence they were. And it came to pass about the time of shutting of the gate, when it was dark, that the men went out. Whither the men went, I wot not. Pursue after them quickly, for ye shall overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof of the house and hid them with the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order upon the roof. And the men pursued after them the way to Jordan unto the fords. And as soon as they which pursued after them were gone out, they shut the gate. And before they were laid down, she came up unto them upon the roof. And she said unto the men, I know that the Lord hath given you the land. Wow. And that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. You know how long ago that was? 40 years. That was 40 years previous, but they still knew of that. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we had heard these things, our hearts did melt. Neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and in earth beneath. Now therefore, I pray you, swear unto me by the Lord, since I have showed you kindness, that you will also show kindness unto my father's house and give me a true token, and that you will save alive my father and my mother and my brethren and my sisters and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. And the man answered her, our life for yours, if ye utter not this our business. And it shall be, when the Lord hath given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with thee. Then she let them down by a cord through the window, for her house was upon the town wall, and she dwelt upon the wall. And she said unto them, get you to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you, and hide yourselves there 3 days until the pursuers be returned, and afterward may ye go your way. And the men said unto her, we will be blameless of this thine oath which thou hast made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, thou shalt bind this line of scarlet thread in the window which thou didst let us down by. And thou shalt bring thy father and thy mother and thy brethren and all thy father's household home unto thee. And it shall be that whosoever shall go out of the doors of thy house into the street, his blood shall be upon his head, and we will be guiltless. And whosoever shall be with thee in the house, his blood shall be upon our head, if any hand be upon him. And if thou utter this our business, then will we be quit of thine oath which thou hast made us to swear. And she said, according unto your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed, and she bound the scarlet line in the window. Now, to go back here and repeat, one woman started as an unbeliever who was not unusually wealthy. One man started as a believer who was wealthy. One woman whose life ended with the blessedness of salvation, the prospect of God's blessing. One man's life ended with the stain of sexual sin, having lost the majority of his family, virtually all of his wealth. One woman who, because of her faith, became a key link in the procreation of the Messiah. One man who, because of his sin, became the key link in the procreation of two evil people groups. One woman, though known as a harlot, became a picture of faith. One man, though known as the nephew of the father of our faith, came to sexual perversion near the end. Yes, we're talking about Lot and Rahab. And we're going to make observations tonight about them and about their families. Lot was drawn by Sodom. At some point, he was drawn by Sodom. And yet, in the end, it is so bleak and so cold and so terrible to read the story that his life was really a shambles. He lost his family. Rahab gave up Jericho. She knew this was going to be destroyed. The Lord, your Lord is God. He's going to win. Just save me and my family. She gave up Jericho, but she was instrumental in saving her family. Now, I want you to think about Lot. Lot had a culture of true worship. What do you mean by that? Well, think about Lot's uncle Abraham. By faith, the Bible says, Abraham chose to leave family and home to claim a promise from the true God. Remember the statement? For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Hebrews 11, 8 through 10. Abraham was a man of faith. He had left his family. He had sacrificed something. Why? To follow the dictate of a God who said, I'll promise you this, just go. And he did go, and he followed the true God, and he separated from family. And Lot was party to that. Lot was a benefactor of that. Lot saw that example for years. I want you to see Abram's testimony. Look at Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter number 18. In verse number 16, Genesis 18, and the Bible says that, go back to verse 1 for a minute, and the Lord appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. In other words, three men were coming, so he goes up and he greets them, and he says, hey, you stay here, we'll make you a meal, you sit down, spend some time, and they did. And so they talk with Abram there. Part of that talk was about a promise. Abram, where's thy wife? She's in the tent. Abram, I'm going to return after a period of time, and you're going to have a son. I'm going to visit you again. You're going to have a son. Well, because remember that Sarah laughs in herself. Really? I mean, I'm old. Abram's old. We're going to have a son. And very interesting. Outside, the Lord says, it's interesting to try to discern in this passage whether the Lord is one of the three that are there or whether the Lord is making part of the conversation with the three angels that are there. But regardless, the Lord says, why did Sarah laugh? And Sarah, well, I didn't laugh. You did laugh. And is anything too hard for the Lord? He gives this promise to Abram. What an interesting conversation. What a dynamic promise over that meal that day. But now begin in verse number 16 of Genesis 8. And the men rose up from thence, and they looked towards Sodom. And Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. He didn't know what was coming next for them. And the Lord said, it's interesting, they start this conversation amongst themselves there. Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham the thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? Have you ever been walking with a group of people and they're talking about you? should we tell him about this? I mean, he's a good guy, and la la la. He's standing right there, pretty much. Now notice what it says though in verse number 19. The Lord says, for I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they will keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. Do you see that? Abram's testimony. God himself says, I know him. He's going to order his family right. He's a good man. Okay? So you have this Abram who's left his family. He's charted a course to sojourn, to not really have a place that he can call his own right now, not really to plant himself deep, but to follow the Lord. He has this testimony with the Lord, and now you see his prayer life, beginning in verse number 20. Behold, now this city is, I'm in the wrong chapter there, verse 20. And the Lord said now to Abraham, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me, and if not, I will know. And the men turned their faces from thence and went towards Sodom. This is so touching to me. Abram's just been told, we're going down to Sodom to check on this wickedness that's come up. He knows judgment is coming. The two men continue on, and he says he stands before now the Lord. And he begins to pray. And I want you to see what he prays based upon. The men turned their faces from thence and went towards Sodom, but Abraham stood yet before the Lord. And Abraham drew near and said, wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure there be 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou also destroy and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are therein? That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked, that be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Wow. Abraham just appealed to God on the basis of his character. God, it's not like you. It's not like you as the judge of the earth to kill righteous people with the wicked. Would you spare it? And he begins to plead for the city of Sodom. Now, do you think Abraham knew that Lot lived in Sodom? I think he did. And you remember the story. He says 40, 30, 20, and he's working the Lord down, and finally he stops at 10. And Lord, I know I'm asking you again, and would you spare it for 10? And the Lord says, I'll spare it for 10. And he goes on. And that's why it's even more stark, I guess, to me, that after you go through chapter 19, and Abram wakes the next morning. I wonder what that night was like. Wonders what the Lord's going to do. We're not talking about the election of a president here or who won the big game. We're talking about the preservation of his city. I've besought God for this, and he stands and he looks. He sees the smoke. Now, maybe he didn't know, maybe he did know because he knew God well enough that though God destroyed the city, he still spared Lot. Remember what he said to Lot? Remember what the angel said to Lot? We can't do anything until you're out of here. We can't destroy this until you're out. So let's get out, get out, get out, all right? But he had to destroy the city. I want you to see, though, his prayer life. So this is the, you think that all of a sudden Abram just, man, he became this really deep guy of prayer all of a sudden. No. No, I think Abram has been a deep man and a deepening man for some time. And what I'm trying to get at here is look at the culture that Lot was in for years. Remember when Abram left Ur of the Chaldees, he actually left with his father-in-law Terah and Lot. Eventually, Terah died in Haran. Then he moved on. Lot's been with him now for some period of time under this influence of a man who would separate himself to God, who had a good testimony, who prayed, who believed in the true God. This was the culture in which Lot was raised. Now, Rahab was immersed in a pagan culture. How do you know that? Well, let's look at a few passages. Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus chapter 18. I want you to see how God, some statements he makes regarding the people that lived in the land prior to the people of Israel. Leviticus 18, verse 24. Defile not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all these the nations are defiled which I cast out before you. And he had prefaced that with a number of sexual sins, okay, not to be involved in. And he said, defile not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all the nations are defiled which I cast out before you. In all these, when you get time later, would you look back at those few that he talked about and see what sins he's talking about? This is amazing. And the land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you. For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled. That the land spew not you out also when ye defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. For whosoever shall commit any of these abominations, even the souls that commit them, shall be cut off from among their people. Therefore shall ye keep mine ordinance, that ye commit not any one of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that ye defile not yourselves therein. I am the Lord your God. He said, these people are so wicked, they've defiled the land, and it's like the land literally regurgitated the people out. They had to go. They were sick. They were disgusting to God. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter number 7. And verse 1. Deuteronomy 7, 1. When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and hath cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. Now we're talking about seven nations. Turn over to 9. chapter 9 of Deuteronomy, verse 4. Speak not thou in thine heart after that the Lord thy God hath cast them out from before thee, saying, for my righteousness the Lord hath brought me in to possess this land. No, but for the wickedness of these nations the Lord doth drive them out from before thee. Now look at Joshua chapter 24. Joshua 24. Joshua says, now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve. Now, interesting how we use that phrase, and it's a good phrase. But in context, you know, we say, choose you this day whom you will serve. I'll serve the Lord. But what he's saying to them, it's interesting. He's saying, if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, if you've ruled out the worship of the true God, choose you this day who you're going to serve. And now look at the options that he gives them. Whether the gods which your fathers served, which are on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I mean, what rabble, what idolatry are you going to choose? Okay, if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose who you're going to serve. These gods or these gods in whom you dwell, but as for me, we're back to the source. We're back to the, we're going to serve the Lord. But talks about the gods of the Amorites in land whose land they dwelled. 2 Kings chapter 16, a couple more verses here. 2 Kings chapter 16 and verse number 3. 2 Kings 16 and verse 3. Talking about Ahaz the king. He walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yea, and made his son to pass through the fire according to the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel. What was one thing that they did? They made their children to pass through the fire, this strange kind of gross, unconscionable worship where you make your children a sacrifice and go through the fire. 2 Chronicles 28. 2 Chronicles 28. And verse number 3. 2 Chronicles 28 and verse number 3. And again, we're talking about Ahaz. Verse number 28, let's start in verse number 2. For he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, made also molten images for Balaam. Moreover, he burnt incense in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and burnt his children in the fire after the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. What am I going to say? This was the culture of Rahab. Because the Bible's telling us that was the abomination, the disgusting state in which the people were that God had to drive out of the land and then let the children of Israel have. So now they stand on the brink of Jericho, beginning the conquest of the land of Canaan here. They're going to drive these people out. This is the description. This is where Rahab lived. So you see Lot over here is in this environment of Abram and separated under the true God, man of prayer, place of peace. Now you have over here Rahab's in just this pit of abomination. That's her culture. Lot had an uncle who was a devout worshiper of God. Rahab seems to have no true religion in her family, thus the need for her to gather them. Now maybe they were seekers, questioners too, I don't know. But Lot was somewhat of a second generation believer. Rahab was a first. Do you remember the sermon on the three chairs? And the decline that can take place as we move down into second generation Christianity, how it wasn't quite as meaningful. Now here's some details and some factors that we do not know. The character and influence of Lot's wife. We don't really know that. The reason he pitched his tent towards Sodom. We know that originally when he was given the choice and they stand there, as one person said, on the spine of Palestine, and they're given a choice and say, okay, which way are you going to turn? Where are you going to take your flocks? Abraham graciously gives him, and it says he looks toward the well-watered plains of Jordan to the east there. So it seems that at least he made an economical decision to say, whoa, this is a great place for cattle. But soon thereafter, it says he pitches his tent towards Sodom. Why? I don't know. But he does. Furthermore, we don't know the reason that he stayed in the wicked city. It says he's come to become a sojourner among us. He came to dwell there. He was kind of taking up residence. In fact, so much so that he was sitting in the gate. What does that indicate? That indicates possibly even had a position in the government of the city. Why did he stay? I don't know. Now, we can make assumptions. Well, I know why he stayed, because he liked the pleasures of Sodom. But listen, we have to be honest with the facts that we know. We're not really told why he stayed. Furthermore, we do not know the depth of Lot's knowledge of God. But, undoubtedly, these do have an impact on the course of our lives. As a side note, the permitted influence of a spouse, the unintended consequences of foolish decisions, the refusal to change ways and a shallow knowledge or surface relationship with God do affect our lives. Maybe it's somebody in our family constantly saying, oh, I sure wish we could have that. I sure wish we could have that. I sure wish we could have that. Boy, if you see a missionary and, oh, yeah, we're called. I'm called to go to here. Boy, and the wife, she's kind of being drug along. How long do you think that's going to last? You want to see them both called. One, see them both surrendered and submitted. How about the unintended consequences of foolish decisions? Okay, he pitched his tent towards Sodom. Oh, and so maybe they saw Sodom. Wow, that's a pretty neat city over there. Oh, I see, it's like they're having a party over there. Here's some music coming out of there every night. Wow, I see a lot of people traveling in and out of there. I bet that'd be a neat place to go. And so maybe they're drawn to this city. At any given point, Lot could have changed direction, couldn't he? He could have said, well, you know, I don't think this is a good idea. You know, from what I've heard about this city, from what I can see, man, just not really comfortable with it. I'll tell you what, let's just pitch our tent a different direction so we're not seeing it. Or let's just maintain our distance. You know, we're cattle people here. We'll stay out here like Uncle Abram is. We're not really going to get into a city and get entrenched. We're just going to stay out here, let the city be the city. But he didn't. And he went into the city, and what happens? The city rebels against King Chedorlaomer, and what does he do? He comes down and captures the whole city and takes him. Guess who he takes with him? Lot and everything he had there in the city. Well, Lot would have never had that problem had he maintained his distance and not been attracted and sucked in by the city. What about the refusal to change ways? Okay, let's say he got all the way in the city. He had implanted himself. He had bought a house and began to raise his kids, and he finally said, man, this is a bad move. I know I've made some really bad mistakes, and I've lost some years of my life, but look at this influence. Look at what it's doing to my kids. I'm just going to change ways right now, and we're going to move back out there. We're going to do whatever it takes to get our kids away from this influence and to try to spare their lives. But he didn't do that. Maybe he had a shallow knowledge or a surface relationship with God. That could have been changed too. And all of those can have a dramatic impact on the course of our lives. But what seems obvious is that Lot did not go to Sodom as a missionary effort. His priorities were probably fleshly, and the expected result was that his influence was essentially nil. And this is amazing. If you look at Genesis chapter 19, back to Genesis, and chapter 19, and look at verse number 9. Genesis 19 and verse number 9. You remember, okay, now the men have gathered around his house. Hey, you got some guests in your house. Let's have them so we can know them. Oh, man, do not so wickedly. Verse number 9 here. And they say, do not so wickedly. Look, I have two daughters. You could take them. Do with you what you want to with them. And they said, stand back. And they said again, this one fellow came in to sojourn. He will needs be a judge. Oh, now he's going to set himself up and tell us what's right and wrong. Yeah, this guy came in to dwell among us, and now he's trying to tell us what we should do. Do you see any influence there whatsoever? I don't. No. For all the time and whatever he had invested in the city, oh, well, we need to be, you know, we need to just jump in there and be the best influence we can be. But look, when you've sacrificed certain things, you have to look at which way the influence is going, okay? I can draw a parallel to our lives today. Well, you know, we just need to get in there among them and be like them and influence them for Jesus. Now, wait a minute. When I started to be like them, I lost my influence for Jesus. Okay, I'm not saying you need to maintain your distance. I don't mean maintain your distance and never go up and shake their hand. I mean maintain your distance doctrinally to say, no, I don't believe those things. I can't partake in that. I can't participate in that. I can't agree with you on that, but I can tell you I can tell you about God and tell you about who he really is and try to be a real friend to you. There was no influence here in coming from Lot on the people of Sodom. His relationship with the Creator God, and he did have a relationship because 2 Peter 2, 7 through 8 says, just Lot vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds, indicating that apparently Lot was a just man, a righteous man in the sight of God. So he had a relationship with Jehovah, but his relationship with the Creator God did not even seem to influence his family. Why? Because it was not communicated or was mixed with such a secular influence as to make it unintelligible. I thought about this. Matthew chapter 13, we have the parable of the ground. Remember that? As the sower, we call it maybe the parable of the sower. The sower goes out to sow, and he sows some seed, and he throws that seed. And Jesus says that seed falls on four different kinds of ground. There's hard ground, and there's stony ground, and there's thorny ground. And then there's good ground. And if I could use that as a picture of life and our families, I say, what kind of a ground are we permitting our families to become? Am I letting the devil so tromp through my family that he's just packing down any opportunity that my children have to hear and understand the word, that by the time they actually hear it and some dear soul or myself tries to sprinkle a little bit of truth on it, it's hard? Or maybe there's a stony soil. Now, the picture there might be a shallow soil with an undergirding of a rock layer. Let me give you the picture of a stony soil in which there's rocks. A lot of rocks. Doesn't grow real well. This year in our garden, we tilled up a spot kind of last minute, you know, just till, and then tried to plant in it. Well, I planted a row of corn, and not a thing came up. There were so many grass clods and everything. So then I went through and I tried to pick out all the clods and I dug a little thing and I put some more corn in. And I think I got like maybe five or six stalks to come up out of the thing. It just was rough. Think about a rocky garden. Okay, it's got rocks and things like that. Not going to grow well. Am I allowing rocks to be dumped or to fall into or to be thrown into my family? Do you follow what I'm saying? Am I allowing things into my family that will make it more difficult for my children to believe and to apprehend truth? Do you remember when he said some fall among thorny ground? The seed is planted and it sprouts, but the thorns come up and they choke the word. Do you remember what the thorns were? The cares of this life. I wonder how many thorn bushes I'm allowing to grow up in my family. Partly because I say, because I'm so concerned about this life. I'm constantly driven by, ooh, the next toy or the next this, or ooh, man, that movie star looks really cool. Yeah, isn't he cool? Oh, dad would just love to have that next sports car. Yeah, I just want to do this hobby, and I want to spend time with here. Oh, I guess we got to go to church and whatever. And by dad's very example, what's he doing? He's planting a bunch of pricker bushes into the family so that when the kids hear the truth, naturally the cares of life, which they've grown accustomed to, they've seen it in dad's life, then It chokes out the word in their own life. So what do I have to do as a dad? To develop a soil, an environment, a context in which my children will receive the word most receptively. What do I need to do? Well, I can't let the devil tromp through and pack down their hearts. And I better be picking stones. When I find those obstructions because of my own leadership or in my own life that would lead to distractions or hindrances for them to accept the truth, I better take that stone, pick it up, and throw it out. Or pick it up right here and throw it out. And then I need to start pulling some briars and pulling some pricker bushes. When I, if I notice in my own life a care and a desire and a worry over worldly things, I better pull that up. Throw it out of the garden of our family. Both cities were destroyed. The importance is not the city, though, but the people that could potentially have been rescued from their destruction. What was the difference? Okay, Rahab, first generation Christian, pagan society, seeker of God, saves family, if you will, going out and telling them, hey, the city's going to be destroyed. God, the God of the Hebrews, is going to win. They are going to conquer us. But if you're in my home, they have come to me and promised me, if you're in my home, you will be saved. She lays her life, really, and her word and all these things on the line. They believe and come. Lot over here, here's a man raised in a, if you will, as much as an Old Testament family can be a God-centered family, he's raised in this nice culture, second generation to some degree, but now he becomes enamored with a secular city and the things which apparently it has to offer, even though it's despicable in its evil or its wickedness as well. And in the process, he loses all influence for whatever reason, whether he's not speaking out or he's not recognizing that they're not influencing, I'm not influencing them, they're influencing me. And in the process, he marries off his daughter to these wicked people and they get destroyed and he loses his family. And wow, two different people, two kind of similar cities, two very different ends. What's the difference? One saw Jehovah as worthy of being trusted with life and the only means of rescue. I love her statement, basically. Your God is God. He's going to win. That's amazing. She had come to that conclusion. She had heard the stories. She had connected the dots. She had found enough out in her pagan society to say, that God's the true God, and I'm going to follow him. She saw God as worthy of being trusted with life and as being the only means of rescue. The other vexed his righteous soul, but he did not leave. One exposed her family to the true God and the promise of deliverance. The other exposed his family to the gospel of Sodom, the Sodomite dream. Now, I say that to say, you know, I guess I'm not entirely shocked, and maybe there's a place for it. You know, you see the politicians get up and they're talking about, you know, their vision for America and how everybody's entitled to the American dream. Let me tell you, as a believer, the American dream is not what we ought to strive for. What is the American dream? I don't know, a couple kids and a nice couple nice cars and a boat and a retirement early and just relaxation. If I work hard, I can get ahead and then relax and have something to pass. Look, there's so much more to life. And there's so that our investments are on a different level here. But he seems to have exposed them to the Sodomite dream of the pleasures of Sodom, the good news of Sodom and not of Jehovah. It seems that the fate of these families was not a fate after all, but the end result of specific choices made by two individuals and those in whose lives they had an influence. Now, the lessons I want us to take away tonight, a few, we're almost done. Number one, the importance of influencing your family, of influencing your own family. How many people, preachers included, have been fired up to pursue the national salvation of America while their families deteriorated around them? And in the end, what do they have to show for it? America is still heading in a secular direction, still making poor choices, still deteriorating. And by the way, we should kind of expect that, because the seeds of America's demise were built into its beginning because it's a nation of people. Okay? And it was a government only made for self-governing people. But people are people. And if they're allowed to have their own way, they're going to self-destruct. And so the more secular influence you have, the more destruction that you have. So we're not really shocked by, to me, we're not shocked by the direction of America. But how many of, man, if I could win one more soul, if I could win a few more souls and get them to the ballot box and change things and we could see things change in America. What about your family? What about the kids that are running around right here? You know, mom might feel like she's at home and, man, I don't get a chance to reach out and I don't get a chance to really influence anybody. Or dad says, yeah, be quiet. I got to call somebody. No, I got to go on visitation. No, I got to. And right here are souls that he has the most intimate contact with. If anybody knows him and to whom he can bear his heart, and if there's anybody that can see him on a day-to-day basis, be who he really is, the way he wants to show himself to other people, it's his kids. Many people have painted Christianity in red, white, and blue. And a part of the problem with that is this. A national decline is perceived as a crumbling Christianity. A secular political decision causes a loss of faith or causes a fretting against God. Oh no! Did you hear what the Supreme Court decided? Yeah, I did. Does that mean that Christianity is imploding and that what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? How are we ever? Wait a minute. Who's my source? Who's my goal? Who's my point of reference? Not the righteousness of my society. It's my God. I want to raise my children to influence people, yes, including politicians if they have the chance. But I want them to know that their faith can be strong no matter what happens to America. The corruption of a city doesn't have to equate with the corruption of my family. Now, I'm not advocating complete isolation. I want them to see their society and to process what's going on from a biblical perspective. They should filter current events through a lens of theology so that even the deterioration of a society only serves to prove the admonitions of Scripture and motivate them to seek an ever closer relationship to the God of truth and reality. I'm not saying we shouldn't pray for the country. I'm not saying that we wouldn't be happy if it made some better decisions. I'm not saying we shouldn't influence our politicians. What I'm trying to get across to you is that if the country runs away from God, that doesn't mean I lose my family. And we need to influence our families. Exercise the influence right here where we have. How? By seeking the true God, by seeing him as worthy of life and him as worthy of the investment of our time and our focus. They're watching. Now, whether they can write it on a list or not, they get where dad's focus is at. They get where mom's focus is at. And if you're planting pricker bushes, throwing stones, and tromping on their good hearing hearts, we're going to lose the family, aren't we? Very good possibility. But if in a heart of seeking God, and God can in grace do some amazing things like he did in the story of Rahab, not much theology there, but she could put two and two together, and by God's grace, he had allowed her to learn about Jehovah, and she accepted that, influenced her family, saw them saved physically, at least we know that much. tremendous changes, tremendous differences. Two similar cities, two different people, two terribly different ends. Where will we end? How will we influence our families? A tale of two citizens. Where are you going to line up?